Hello, welcome back to Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast that delves into the heart of food service equipment and the hospitality sector. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor. And whether you're an operator, a designer, or someone who just loves the mechanics of a great commercial kitchen, you're in the right place. Today, we're sitting down in the studios in Canary Wharf in London again. It's good to be back in London. And I'm joined by two absolute heavyweights in their respective fields for our industry. First of all, I've got a consultant with me, Ian Clay, who's been in our industry for 30 years, and he's the brains behind Hunsworth Food Service Design and also the founder of Ducted Solutions. And later in the show, I'm joined by George Fell, who's the equipment sales director of HD Trading, who are the exclusive importers of Scotsman ice machines for the UK. Speaking of Scotsman, this episode is proudly sponsored by Scotsman, part of the Alley Group. And in the studio, we've got Michaeli with us, but he's sitting quietly. So let's get on with the show. Ian, it's good to see you.
You too, Radford.
Thank you for braving it all the way down from Yorkshire.
It's worth the 2.5 hour journey.
Before we sort of get on with like the heavy stuff, like your business and or businesses and what you do, if we don't mind, we can just start with a little bit of personal. You know, you came in the industry 30 years ago, I think, starting out with Victor, and made your way through major distributors, and then going on to CAD and ventilation, etc. So tell us a little bit about, like, you know, your early years, like school, where you brought up, and then just quickly into your career.
I come from a humble background, usual comprehensive, that kind of thing. Born and bred from Leeds, West Yorkshire. Very proud to be a Yorkshireman. I've worked all over the country, but Leeds is where I call home.
Okay.
I started out actually working for the Yorkshire Bank. That's how I started working. Oh, okay. I was 15 when I first started the job. Only for a week. So I worked for them for 3 years. But I've always been interested in engineering. I was using early versions of CAD as a child. Right. I was very lucky to have those opportunities. And so I took the opportunity at Victor to work for them for 2 years, where I learned to use the CAD on a professional basis. But I also loved the fact I was taken under the wing by the foreman, who would show me how the equipment was built and how to develop design. So that fascinated me as well. At the same time, we used to do the quotes, the warranties, taking the calls for new inquiries. It was a broad spectrum role, but it was wonderful as a new start in the industry.
Yeah.
What I realised quickly was how narrow the field was with servers. And so I took a role with Lockhart's by that point.
Okay. Everyone's almost had national service of catering equipment.
I only worked for Lockhart's for 2 years, but I loved working for them. I worked for a chap called Vernon Stott, who was a real old stalwart in the industry. He was related to the Stott-Benham family, that kind of thing. So he was a proper old stalwart of the industry. I worked for them for a couple of years. That's where I really got into the kitchen design side of it. And then I went to probably my most longest tenure, which was at Airedale, where I was there for 14 years. I worked under the stewardship of a chap called John Rhodes, who was one of my great mentors. And we shared a deep passion for design, a deep passion for the industry. And he had this view of where I would be in the industry, within the business. Started out in the drawing office and went my way up through to the national accounts business, where three of us used to bring in half the company's turnover. So we had quite a lot of responsibilities with multiple national accounts. I then moved on to CDG for a little while just to get a bit of a change. They were predominantly at the time looking after blue chip clients and contract caterers, so your OCRs, people like that. That was a completely different ball game, complete change from dealing with schools and dealing with smaller restaurateurs to large corporate clients, you know, significant budgets, significant approach. So that was a trip to London from Yorkshire on a weekly basis, you know, wearing the pinstripes, speaking to various people. It was always, you never met an Englishman. They were always from another country. And it was always fascinating to have a chat with them. So I enjoyed that role. But I did a project in York for a rather well-known chocolatier in that part of the world. And that reminded me I needed to come back home. And that's why I ended up working for Walton's for a little while.
Okay.
I worked for Walton's for nearly 7 years. I started off in the sales team and moved from the sales team into behind the scenes quite quickly because they needed some improvements, shall we say. And that's where I kind of developed that. I had a small team and we would basically design and deliver the project. So I managed that. And Yeah, we did that until, unfortunately, the company
started your company.
Its demise. Yeah, that's really what was the seed to start.
So when did you start your own business?
So I started my own business during COVID.
That was the business.
So the company, John had always said to me that I would run my own business one day. This is John Rhodes I was talking about earlier. And he said to me, you will run your own business one day. I've always had that acumen. I've always been interested in the wider process. So, for example, I've never been exclusively a designer. I can do the whole process from brief through to training, right across the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in how things impact other things. So I'd understand like how the credit process works, so that I would get sales through the accounts department. It was understanding how the warehouse worked, how all the different parts of the business worked, so that it could make it as easy as possible. So when Waltons was already struggling financially before COVID hit, there was already signs that things were going to change. That was one of the reasons why I was thinking, right, okay, this needs to happen now. Another reason, I've been in the industry by this point, 25 years, I've been at it long enough to think, actually, yes, I could do this. I've got the experience, I've got the background. And surprisingly, the majority of my clients when I started Huntsworth were not the people I'd been working with. They were new people, and that was wonderful. It's a real affirmation. And so that was really good. But I started the business simply, I realised that as the industry was having to rethink their financial situation, their commitments, having an in-house designer and finding all the work for an in-house designer for the all of the time.
Big commitment.
Was a big commitment. Mm. So this ability to be able to tap into somebody with my experience and be able to bring that to the table to smaller companies seemed a concept that would work.
Yeah.
And the thinking was, if it'll work during COVID, it'll most definitely work beyond that.
Okay, so as we get on, I'm going to come back to the business in a minute and then we'll ask a bit more detail about that. But how do you kind of switch off? You're busy with your two companies, and how do you switch off from work?
It's a difficult one to answer because, to be fair, I never switch off. No matter where I go, if we go out for dinner, my wife always places me with my back to service. I never really stop. I'm always looking at things. I'm always checking things out. I would never call myself a foodie ever in a million years.
Right.
I'm the last of my family, so I've had a look into the generations, and it would appear there's six generations of butchers in the family. There's a couple of chefs, a couple of bakers. So clearly food is in the DNA somewhere. Mm. And obviously I make a meat toad in the hole. I mean, that's okay. A lot.
And do you cook at home much?
Yeah, absolutely. I like to cook. I wouldn't say I cook on a regular basis. My wife would remind everybody of that. But yes, I do like to cook. I find it quite relaxing. When I used to be a little bit more stressed and a lot bit more responsibilities at one time, I used to do a lot of baking, a lot of making bread. There's nothing more de-stressing than smacking some dough into the tabletop, you know, and kneading the bread. It's one of those things. I do like to get into, I've got lots of passions, lots of interests. I'm into basically how things work. So from people to rockets, anything. Mm-hmm. I'm the family geek, as it were, hence the conversations we've had earlier.
Mm.
But I also love architecture, I love art, and there's a good chance I'll be stopping off at the National Gallery before I head home.
Nice. Okay. So when you launched your design business, if we talk about that business first, you know, tough time. It was a tough time for the world, not just the UK. And a bold move, you know, stepping out and starting your own business. I mean, how was that?
It's interesting you ask the question. You're not the first, and I imagine not the last, that will ask the same question. The amount of people have said to me, how did you get on starting a business through the pandemic? And at the end of the day, there was still business going on. There were still things needed to be done. People needed to repair equipment. People needed to make adjustments to their kitchens. And so I was very lucky to get the support of distributors who reached out to me saying, can you help us? One of the companies I deal with today was the first company that reached out to me, and he's now actually my business partner with my other business, with Ducted.
Okay.
But I didn't know him from Adam. We'd never met. We'd never talk to each other. And this is what I was saying earlier about this affirmation, people reaching out looking for your support who have never met you. And that was wonderful.
Yeah.
And I found that really, really quite, really good. So, yeah, we've talked about the reevaluation process. So what the company essentially does is provide. So majority of my clients are distributors. Mm-hmm. So my business is kind of split into sort of two parts. There's the lion's share of it is a white label work for distributors. So yeah. Distributors will have gone to see a client. Sometimes they'll ask me to go see the client on their behalf. They'll bring me a brief, a wall layout of some kind, and can you sort that out kind of thing. So I
produce. A lot of trust.
Absolutely. Well, I'm very funny about being confidential, so I won't discuss any of my clients with anybody else. I've always been like that. I feel that if you're going to trust me with something that's so important to them, because all sales are confidential in one way or another, I'm being allowed behind the door, as it were, within businesses. So I have a number of clients who I have full access to their systems. You know, it's really trusting. I have multiple email accounts for other companies where I contact their clients directly, and again, that's trust, because you know we like to control the sale. That's what we're taught as salesmen. But that's the kind of trust that I receive. So I have the white label work, which is predominantly the distributors, and what I tend to do is not only produce the, I'll do an outline design, a complete design, but the way I do my drawings produces a what I call a skeleton quotation. So it produces either a shopping list for my client, or I can do that into AutoQuotes, and I produce a almost fully populated AutoQuote. So all they have to do then is add in their margins and their costs. But it means that I'm taking out a huge amount of the, some people work. Might call the donkey work of the job out of it. But instead of taking several hours to do a 100 item quotation, you know, it could take half an hour, 40 minutes. It's a lot quicker. So that's one of the things I do. The other side of things that I do is with other clients directly on a consulting basis. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a new area for me when I started on Hunsworth. I mean, we're into our 7th financial year, the 6th year operating, so which is amazing. And so I get architects coming to me, getting a sense of things. We get landlords coming out to me saying, can you give us a sense of what we could achieve in this space? And that's been quite interesting. That's opened the doors to some interesting projects. I did a project in Tokyo, talking about Japan earlier. I've done a project in Canada, a project in Rome, and I've got a project coming up in the Maldives.
Wow, nice.
Unfortunately, none of them have got any site surveys.
Which is
such a shame.
I mean, it's a kind of brilliant model, really, because you know you're offering that high level experience on a kind of on demand basis to distributors,
be it
2D, be it BIM, 3D, whatever. So yeah, I mean, absolute kudos to you, because I think it's a fantastic add on for most companies. Do you find that when you talk to new distributors and things like that, they get it, they understand what you're doing? And
to be fair, when you think of the cost of what a designer costs you these days full time, when they realise the significant saving and the asset that I bring to their business,
they get it
straight away. And what I always say to my clients, and I've said this in many interviews, I will come work for you for a month free. I'll prove what I can do quite happily. So my clients often will come to me with the drawings that I've done by a previous designer and say, what would you do with this? I'll redevelop their borders to make them more consistent and much more modern and contemporary. I'll update their drawings. My drawings tend to be a bit more colourful, a little bit more, there's more of a visual impact to it, because drawings can quite often be very flat. And in this day and age, people don't really understand them as well as they used to do, or they're not as willing to translate them probably. And so making them clear to understand, giving them some impact, it's a sales tool at the end of the day. And that's my core value, is to be an asset to the organisation that you're working with, but to make them look good at the end of the day. So the drawings, the quotes, whatever it is you're producing, give them something that makes it saleable for them to achieve that sale, to get it over the line, as it were.
And that sort of brings us nicely into your second business.
Oh, yes.
Which is Ducted Solutions.
Yes.
Which I know we spoke about on the phone.
Yes.
But ventilation, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? No one really has an opinion about it until it goes wrong. and when it goes wrong, it's massive.
And expensive.
Yes. So what is that business? I mean, yeah.
So none of my businesses sell any products. All of my businesses are service products, service businesses, and there's a reason for that. It's not as lucrative potentially, but the reason why I do that is I enjoy that process, and my feeling is they're tapping into that experience and knowledge. So the reason why Doctor came about was when I was consulting, and when I've been spending the last 20 odd years delivering projects, one of the things that would slow the sale down was the client getting planning.
Okay.
And often the ventilation companies who are focused on the sale aren't necessarily providing the client with the complete information they need to get through planning. Often the budget defines the equipment that's being provided in the quotation or into the specification of the ventilation system,
yeah,
which isn't necessarily what will get them through planning.
Yes.
So often the pieces that the client are given are very much piecemeal. There isn't a cohesive document that they can put forward to the planning authorities for them to read. Planning authorities are not experts. Hmm. They have a tick list per se, that they need to see and clearly go, yes, 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 yes. And unfortunately, that's not always available. What Ducted does, and from what we've been told by the companies we deal with, so we deal with a number of the well-known brands that support all of this, so not just the manufacturer, mainly the manufacturers, so one of the well-known manufacturers, Purified Air, we do a lot of work with them, but we do other works. But we've been told our package is almost unique at the moment in the industry. Our noise impact assessment team, so the acoustic consultants, have told us our packs are really good. And the reason why they're really good is it's 65 pages thick, but it's laid out in a clear format that answers all of the questions the planners are looking for. And we don't think about budget. We think about what does the client need to get it through planning.
Yes.
And that's why we don't sell anything, because it's the client. If the client then decides to cut corners with the budget later, that doesn't impact the planning.
Yeah.
Because that's later, after the planning's been.
Okay. So you're working for...
So we work predominantly with directly with operators.
Operators,
owner,
yep,
operators. We work with landlords as well, so we get landlords asking us to assess systems as well. So if they're looking to rent a space out, so they've had a restaurant to run the place, and they then want to see if that person wants to leave and they want to replace them, is that going to be an acceptable system? Does it need adjustment? If they wanted to rent the space above, is there going to be problems? We've had a couple of them projects, actually. So that's another avenue that we're looking at. We get clients coming to us from the pubs from a ventilation point of view, what they call purge air, which was a new one to us of late.
But right,
again, that's another area we've got into. So,
and anyone that kind of knows, you know, trying to open a restaurant in a heavy residential area could be challenging, because you've got noise, odour, assessments, this kind of thing. Is there kind of like a one mistake that you see a lot? I mean, not really,
yes,
negative, but
yes. The biggest mistake is they underestimate how complex the ventilation system is. There seems to be this view that it's a box on the wall, a hole at the back of it, and a fan.
Yeah.
The reality is it's way more complicated than that. We need to consider the odour control. We need to consider the noise. We need to consider the grease. We need to consider how it's going to impact the local environment. And when it comes to the planning, the other side of it is, where is all that plant that's going to do all that to going to go? So,
yeah,
for example, if we put a carbon system in, the carbons can be 6 foot long, 2 feet high, 2 feet wide. They're big. And they're heavy. You know, we've just done a system where the carbons, the ESP, that's the bit that gets rid of the grease, it weighs nearly 1,500 kilos, and it's been suspended from a concrete slab. You know, these things people underestimate, and the cost, of course, that goes with that. You know, carbons are 180, £200 each, and some of these systems have got 27 carbons, and they need to be replaced anything between 3 and 6 months at a time, depending on how busy the site is. So it's having, I think, when clients are looking at sites, they need to think, where will all the plant for the ventilation system go?
Go, yeah.
And there's an underestimation of that more often than not.
Okay. Well, Ian, thank you for that. Some great advice and great insights. If you don't mind, like, hanging about for a bit, we're going to invite George Fell into the studio and have a chat to him about his business and also about Scotsman, and then come back for a group chat. So now I'm joined by George Fell, who's the equipment sales director for HTG Trading. George has flown in from Scotland. George, welcome to the show. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. Thank you for inviting me.
Seamless journey into city?
Yeah, pretty good. I live about 35 minutes from the airport, so I can plan my journey with a bit of fast-track security, and I can get to the car park and get through security in about 5 minutes and be there just at the gate ready to go. So that's always a convenience, especially if you're doing one-dayers. I do quite a lot of one-dayers to London.
Yeah.
Really early flight, late-night flight back. I don't always go to city, but sometimes to Stansted, because our head office is in Ipswich. So I'd hire a car and drive out to Ipswich and do some meetings, then come into London and fly back. But yeah, the combination is always the same. It's always an early flight and a late one back, so which my wife loves.
Cool. So, George, you've been with HTG Trading for about 10 years, I think?
Yeah, 2015 I joined. So this is my 11th year now. Yeah. So.
And you're looking after sales, Scotland and England, but across the UK as well?
Or? Yeah, so when I joined in 2015, I was a lowly salesperson on the road, just a business development manager for Scotsman, brought in to grow the Scotland market. That then, because we're based in Ipswich, looking at a map, Scotland's quite small, so you might as well have Ireland, Northern Ireland as well. So I then had Scotland and Northern Ireland for selling Scotsman. And then, well, the north of England's not that far from Scotland, so we'll add that on as well. So all those things. So then from a business development perspective on Scotsman, the thing was to grow a product that hadn't seen a development manager for 15 years. We hadn't, because of based in Ipswich, the Scottish market wasn't touched that much. Our CEO, our now CEO, employed me. His idea was to grow that market back in. And then my job just grew arms and legs from there, from being business development manager to national sales manager to then sales director for Hubbard, and then now sales director for the whole company, so covering all aspects of HTG.
Recently become sales director, though.
Yeah, so April last year, it sort of all started to head my way. All the extra, so 10 salespeople on the road across a number of different brands. On the Scotsman side, we have 4 salespeople, and then on the T, which is the Taylor side, we have 6 salespeople dealing with national accounts, dealing with just end user customers. You know, your seaside resorts, all those different things would buy all our products. The company is split in a manner that the H Hubbard is through distributors, so we sell to care and equipment suppliers, refrigeration engineers. I've always found the small refrigeration engineers kind of get a hard time because they're up against a lot of the online purchase equipment, so they don't often get much of a sale in that way. So one of our huge targets is looking after the refrigeration dealers, making sure that they've got opportunity to buy our product, as well as the large online players. And then the Taylor side of the business, or the T, which is also inclusive of Barista Tech, which is a coffee arm to our business, is an end user sale. We go out and see our client
ice
base.
Ice cream machines,
coffee machines, display refrigeration and gelato, batch equipment through Frigomat. We do lots of different products in with that. And obviously then the national account side, kind of some national accounts will not buy through a dealer. They will only go direct to manufacturer. And as the manufacturer arm in that, then we would look after them in that way too. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That kind of makes sense. So just before we get more into Scotsman and those products, if you like, how long have you been in the industry? Is it the 10 years or were you before?
Yeah, so 11 years. So when I left...
so you came
straight into doing it, yeah. Okay. I left my previous job and said, you know, this one had 2 really poor jobs back to back.
Right.
And I said, this next one needs to be the one I stick at and stay with, and it must be. So I made it my own, and here I am as sales director. So
and
I think it worked.
You're from Edinburgh, brought up in Edinburgh?
So I actually grew up on the west coast of Scotland, so a place called Kintyre. So if you know the Paul McCartney of Kintyre song.
Well that was
written about the peninsula on the side of Scotland, which is Kintyre. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a very small town called Campbelltown and lived there until I was 19, and then left to come to college. Dropped out of college after a year and then got a job and worked in sales. And sales is an unquantifiable skill, and people have it or they don't. You often see that through interviews of new individuals. So found a real niche in working in sales, and I've built a sales career from there. So
okay. So you're obviously clearly enjoying our industry because you're 10, 11 years into
yes,
it.
Yes, so yeah.
Once you're in it, that's it. You can't kind of leave it, I think.
Yes, yeah.
It's all about the people. So you guys are the dedicated importer and service provider for Scotsman.
Yes.
I think for over 50 years.
Yeah, so 1964, I believe, is the correct date of inception of the Hubbard Refrigeration, Hubbard Systems model, bringing in Scotsman as a product. Hubbard Refrigeration, Hubbard Systems split, I believe, in the late 90s with a sort of a purchase and then a change of head office address and stuff like that. But yeah, carried on the Scotsman brand that whole time. We had a lot of support and a lot of connections through Scotsman over those years. So Alessandro de Blasio was our main contact for a number of years, and a really, really good relationship with him. And Scotsman as a brand has, you know, supported us through, and we have that real sort of close connection. Our technical management team speak to research and development at Scotsman, and we're kind of like the test bed for new products that they may want to be introducing. We get, you know, landed with the new Dicise product, the new modular machine lands with us, and we pull it apart and see if it's going to fit within
it
the
works,
industry.
Yeah.
We give them the feedback back. We go out and see them and spend time with them and talk to them about their new developments. And it's kind of a real trust basis. So we see them as a part of our family rather than just selling their product. It's we you know them all by first name and spend a lot of time with them and, you know, sit in their canteen. The Scotsman factory's got a really, really nice feel because it's kind of a bit old Italian area, but then you go into the canteen and it's just all the workers are all in one place, so you all have pasta together and sit down and enjoy, and it's like that real feel of family, I would say, with doing that. So nice company to work with, for sure.
And Scotsman as a brand, it's ice machines.
So they have the I always say this, they have the largest range of ice type. So we see ice as a key part of any service within really whatever you're doing, bars, restaurants, nightclubs, you know, coffee shops. Obviously, coffee's predominantly growth into ice has changed. And Scotsman's product range lends itself to that nature. So whether it be the Gourmet Supercube, which is your solid gin bar, whiskey, you know, long melt time product, or whether it's Dice for quick service, QSRs, it's formed in a slightly different way. So it melts quicker, which is great for displacement, which means your Pepsi sales or Coca-Cola sales are much higher.
Yep.
Other brands are available. or it's down to their nugget or flake ice, which is either good for, again, QSR high volume places, or flake ice for packaging fish and transport. And then they have countertop dispensed style, so your Nando's and different things like that, the push button self-serve product. So we have opportunity with everybody we speak to give them a solution for them. It's a silver box that freezes water, but at the end of the day, it's choosing the right ice product for you. So you have to calculate how much ice they're going to use. You know, it's a huge oversight when somebody, you know, I use the example of when I started, 6 months in is the best example I've ever had of this, is Six Nations weekend, brand new gym bar in the middle of Edinburgh opens, and they buy a 60 kilo ice machine to deal with their service. Now, that's not 60 kilos in storage or 60 kilos at any one moment. It's 60 kilos in 24 hours. 60 kilos looks like a big number when you buy it. You think, great, I've spent £1,500. I've got a 60 kilo ice machine. That ice only stores 10, 16, 24 hours. They ran out in about 20 minutes. And we were called in.
Wow.
We were called in on the Monday to basically see how we resolve this problem for them. And I said, well, how did you get ice to this point? And they were transporting it up the street with bin bags from a partner site. So you then say, well, actually, the truth of it is that 60 kilo ice machine is you need 120 kilos in storage, which means you then need a 215 kilo ice machine to fill that storage quick enough for you to fill your wells and all these different things. So it's pay twice, right? You buy one ice machine, then you have to buy another ice machine because your first choice was too small. So Scotsman's product range allows us to offer you the best solution at that moment that gives you a better future, you know, future-proof your business in terms of having the right amount of ice and product and stuff like that, rather than buying one, it not being as reliable or too small for the job, and then having to buy another.
I think it's a fair comment as well. It's a bit like what I was saying to Ian earlier, that no one really has an opinion on ice really in projects until it goes wrong, and then everyone's got an opinion.
Yes, exactly right.
Get passionate about combi ovens and cook suites and griddles and you know,
we call it the 10 product. So 90% of the time you think about all the other things, your combis and all the things that look like they make you money, and then 10 being the ice machines and little components in the world. When they go wrong though, they're the 90, and the 10 all, you know, seem to just continue to work. So an ice machine is very, very important, and I believe specking it at the start is the key to the whole thing, is the right ice, the right volume for the customer.
How big is Scotsman globally as a business?
I mean, they have distributors in every region in the world. It's huge, yeah, it's absolutely massive,
yeah.
There's a top two, a top three, they would say. Yeah. In the market, Scotsman being one of those three. Mm. In the UK, we would suggest that we're the sort of main or the largest of those three in the UK in terms of what we cover and who we cover. Mm. I mean, they'd love it if they listen to this. They'd love that. But we take a lot of pride in the Scotsman brand and pushing it into our clients. And obviously, we see a lot of international clients coming to the UK. The UK has always been the testbed for opening a new restaurant. So whether it be a new chicken brand from the US or whatever, they always test it in the UK and see whether it'll work in Europe.
Yeah.
Well, if they buy it in the US, then they trust Scotsman. They buy it in the UK. If they use it in China and they buy Scotsman there, they buy it in the UK, right? They want to use the same products across the board, and we're always there to offer them the solution that they have. Sometimes the machine model number is different, but the end goal is the same ice or whatever.
And you as a business have seen some serious growth recently. I mean, pushing your market share up by about 34%, some data that I've received.
Yeah.
Peter Gray, who I know, your MD, has recently said that the success isn't just about market-leading products, it's about all the backup and support. How important is that, really?
Yeah, massive. So, I mean, being an old business, so, if I talk about a technical manager, Mark Stebbings, he's been with us he's been working for 36 years, and 36 years he's been working for Hubbard Systems. So he has known the Scotsman product forever. So there's a lot of people in the industry will know him from just picking up the phone from a technical perspective. We have 21 engineers on the road who look after ice machines, which is after a huge project that we're doing this year in part of our business, we'll see us raise to about 46 engineers on the road with maintenance technicians and different things like that. So it's a huge change in the way that works. But one of the key things is our third party network as well. So because we bring all the parts, all the warranties and everything within house, we look after I mentioned the refrigeration dealers earlier on. We rely on them in remote areas looking after their own product, but support them through our dealer compensation scheme so that they don't feel like they're being stung when they have to go and repair a machine. Mm-hmm. So we will not only just give them back the cost of the parts, there is also a labor aspect to what they can claim too. So we know things go wrong. Not every single time the machine has failed, it's potentially something the customer's done, but we'll always have that conversation. Our warranty team, Mark I mentioned earlier, will always review those and make sure that they're being supported within that. Yeah, the Scotsman brand's market share was born out of Scotsman being very bold in COVID. So, Ian said earlier on about starting a new business during COVID. Well, buying lots of component parts to build a lot of ice machines during COVID was bold as well. Mm. We, as that family relationship I said earlier on, we knew they were doing that. So we doubled down our efforts at the same time and said, look, let's just buy the same amount of equipment that we had before COVID, they'll buy the same number of parts. Let's build the same amount of machines and let's see what happens. Well, what came out of COVID was a huge boost to the market. There was loads of expenditure, a lot of spare cash, a lot of people wanting to do projects. And the other big two didn't keep up. So they didn't build in the same level. They didn't have the spare components. So our sales rocketed off the back of it.
Well, you got the market share.
Yeah. So if you said earlier on that people don't really look at their ice. Well, it was proven. There's this misconception, and it'd be a nice segue to talk about it, that the shape of the cube, our gourmet being round, is not as good for the bar shaking cocktail makers. So then they're very hell bent on buying square cube, right? So that's like, this is an industry thought process. Well, the reason that is because they were trained on that particular shape of cube. But if you think about it schematically, or think about it in any sense, a cocktail shaker is rounded. It's round on the outside. So what you're going to do as soon as you put a square cube in is you're going to knock the corners off it. When you knock the corners off an ice cube, that shard of ice will melt quicker. Well, then that dilutes your drink. Well, why not use a rounded cube to offer that sort of shaking aspect? Then it will cool the drink without diluting it. But Scotsman have seen that, and Alessandro and now Michele, our contact at the factory, have seen that and thought, well, do you know what? let's have some share of that. So there's now the new EXS range, which will be A Square Cube Gourmet from Scotsman. So we see the Gourmet Cube as the market leader in terms of melt time and quality. It is formed essentially upside down vertically using a spray bar system, creates a mist, which means that you have a lot less impurities in the ice, so it forms much clearer. So then they've just then taken that model of making that Gourmet Cube and turn it into a Square Cube. So Scotsman synonymous with quality of ice product, we will now have a Square Cube for the market.
The same,
starting soon.
Okay, and I mean, you're right, you know, the ice machine goes down on Friday and the bar manager is probably pulling his hair out thinking, what the heck am I going to do? And we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of ice types because it's a whole science behind it, as I've kind of also learned a bit. But before that, we're just going to hear from our sponsor and then I'll invite you back. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the world of Ali, the largest and most diverse food service equipment company on the planet. With over 110 brands under the Ali Group umbrella, we serve more than 150 countries worldwide. Our brands are at the forefront of innovation, offering cutting-edge technology and ergonomic designs that keep pace with the ever-evolving market. But we're not just a global leader, we're a network of local companies working together to deliver excellence. To learn more, visit aligroup.com.
So welcome back. We're going to invite Ian to join us. George is still with me in the studio. Welcome back, gentlemen. Let's talk about ice, okay? That's kind of what we're going to start with. I think people just think like ice is just ice, isn't it? I mean, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very funny. I think the thing is that you see an ice cube and until you work in the industry, you maybe potentially don't look at your glass and go, oh, I wonder where that ice is from. You just see ice in a glass. How quickly it melts, nobody ever times it, right? You know, if it's of a certain shape or whatever, right? You just have no opinion on it. Well, when you work in the industry and when you start to understand what ice does to a product, we don't see it as just ice. We see it as an ingredient. Like, you can't have that quality of drink without the right ingredient, right? So you wouldn't skimp on a vodka for the right particular drink. You wouldn't skimp on your whiskies. Why would you skimp on your ice? Choose the best product for it. I think for us, ice is an ingredient. It's not just ice in your glass. Mm. So choosing the right ice cube for your customer base, or then also you as a you know, whether it be a barista, choosing the right ice cube for making their iced coffees. Because using a solid gourmet cube, which is a spray bar clear ice, which you would use in a gin and a whiskey, necessarily isn't great for a barista style because it's too hard. It doesn't displace as much. It takes up too much space in the glass. So then you go for a half dice, which is a much softer, easier melt product, which then dilutes and is easier to blend and all that sort of stuff. And then you can move to more displacement with a nugget ice. There's loads of options available in it. And, you know, I think, Ian, probably when you're specifying things, you get these questions from customers.
It is. It's a classic question. Mm-hmm. And it's underestimated, under-considered. The point you raised about not having the right size capacity in the first place is an absolutely classic, isn't it? Yes, certainly. The size of the ice, when to use it, what it's doing, I couldn't agree more. Problem I come across is where they locate the ice machine. Mm-hmm. That's the big challenge I come across. Mm-hmm. If they underestimate or they don't consider the fact that it's obviously heat exchange processes, refrigeration, and they put them in a tiny space, the heat builds up, and then they wonder why it doesn't produce the amount of ice that it says on the tin. And of course it never will do, because it's having to work so hard for that.
Affected by ambient temperature, affected by water, it's laws of thermodynamics. You know, you don't have to go too physics-y or too science-y, but it's very much, if the water's hot and the air's hot, then water takes longer to freeze, right? You need a lot more refrigeration duty. If you put more refrigeration duty in, the more hot air it makes it hot, you know, to be able to do
like a vicious circle.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
And across the other side of that coin is drainage.
Yeah, yeah.
Because often they're not pumped. I mean, your machines are more often pumped, aren't they? But there's a lot of companies out there that aren't pumped. Yeah. And so you've got this very low level because of the condensate point. You know, if you've got a bin on a modular ice machine, the bin is literally maybe 4 or 5 inches, 100 mil off the ground.
Yeah.
So the drainage has to be ground, you know, a hole in the ground rather than conventional drainage that's mounted at 300-400 mil off the wall.
Yeah.
So that's that's another thing that people underestimate.
Yeah, they also do.
I mean, when you're designing kitchens or bars,
yes,
what's the approach to specifying ice machines?
Understand the peak demand. We've touched on that earlier.
Understand
the peak demand. What is the place doing? How much are they likely to use at the worst case scenario? It's like kitchen design. Don't build a kitchen with the daily. Work on what's the worst case. So, for example, if you're doing a small kitchen, if it's doing a Christmas dinner, that's kind of the maximum it's ever going to do. So what can we get in there that will cover all of that? So it's the same mentality with ice machines. Mm-hmm. What's the maximum that we need to be aiming for with that machine? Going back to storage capacity, you know, if it only holds 20 kilos or it's producing 60 kilos in 24 hours, mm-hmm. that's not a huge amount of ice.
Mm-hmm. Sounds quickly, a lot, but...
And that's why bars have ice wells. Mm-hmm. It's a form of pre-storing some of the ice.
But part of the calculation is working out how big those ice wells are, because
Bingo.
You could then have an ice bin that then is empty as soon as you fill your ice wells. Well, you then need backup ice, or you need to maybe you do a champagne or something like that from behind the bar, and you need the bucket of ice, and you're not taking it from your ice well. The thing with ice wells as well, it melts quicker, right? Because it's not got friendly ice around it. It disappears a lot quicker. So when you're transferring it and moving it, there's things about transportation of that. There's a calculation that we've always made is a third of a kilo of ice per cover in a restaurant is how we usually calculate what you need.
Oh,
so
really?
If you, nice takeaway.
Yeah. So
it's on the side. You need 20 kilos of ice.
Yes. Yeah. Per cover. So don't think through how many times you go through that cover. So like if then it does, you know, if they rotate it a number of
and
times.
They do three or four services, five services, whatever they do.
And that's how you get to that point. I mean, that's a huge industry, like, secret from my side. So don't tell too many people. But, yeah, it's...
I think you just have.
Yeah.
It's about 20,000.
It's what we've always used as a calculation. And you can... And it is a very good science because we see it when somebody comes to replace. You can't get to site for whatever reason they're shot. And you talk to them about those specific things and say, well... What's your volume? What you're doing? You know, how many covers? And you tend to, and I've done it before, where you've got back to the machine that they bought previously. And you're like, well, this is the exact same machine or replication. Even if they don't know the model number, you go in and you're taking out the machine that was there before.
And then they're wondering why it's not improved. It's a new machine.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, how many sites have we been to where the client is freezing? The moment the ice machine empties in the bin, they empty the bin, bag it, put it in a freezer, and then just constantly producing ice, thinking, oh, well, we'll have that as a backup, rather than thinking, you know, we need to have a machine that can actually cope with what we need.
Yeah.
We touched on this earlier, you know, storing ice, and the people under it, using the word again, people don't consider the health and safety concerns for ice as well. You know, people just think it's ice, but, you know, you've got all sorts of it's stuff that you don't want in an ice well if it's not regularly emptied and regularly cleaned. Mm. And we touched on that earlier, didn't we?
I mean, I think one of the things about storing ice and where Scotsman do really win with the Gourmet Cube and also the EXS, the new square cube that is coming, will have the same, because of the lack of impurities in the ice, the clear cube, there's a collar on the base of the ice cube when it's formed, which essentially is the widest part of the cube. Now, you would say that if a square cube has a slightly bigger collar, it's no longer square, it's a different, slightly different shape. But there's a huge benefit to that collar. It happens with the round and it will happen with the square. When an ice cube sticks to another ice cube, if you have a full flat surface area, both sides of that cube will stick together. You end up with one big block of ice.
They'll freeze together.
They will freeze together. If you have a collar, then that surface area that touches is very, very small. Right. And they separate apart. So from a stored bag of ice, a quick drop with a Scotsman cube, all the ice will separate. And that's why if you go to the supermarket and you go into the thing, you don't see a frozen square cube. You see a round cube. Because all the large ice manufacturers use Scotsman cubes in the supermarket.
Secrets today.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of sites are buying the ice in.
Yeah.
And not what's the difference there really? Is it about quality or?
I think there's a lot of pressure on CapEx. I mean, Ian said earlier on that he's talking about, you know, budget outweighs you know, the what equipment they're going to use. So people then look at their CapEx spend and go, well, I can't afford £3,000 for an ice machine because it's the right size ice machine or whatever. So they just cut that off their budget.
Buy it in.
And then they buy it in. Well, it's a, if you're a busy site, it's a false economy because then the cost of that is, you know, is massive.
100%.
The transport, the added bits, how much do you need? Well, when somebody gets to that point in their business that they need to buy an ice machine because they realize they've spent too much on ice, we just ask them how many bags of ice they buy a day, a week, a month, and that's how much we give them in storage and in production. Mm. So really, they're already doing the calculation for us by knowing what they've been buying up until that point. And a lot of the ice production houses that do that tend to use a Scotsman Cube because it doesn't stick together when you freeze it.
Well, there are other brands out. It is interesting. Obviously, from my point of view, it's not an existing site. It's often a new site, and they've no idea how much ice they're going to need. And so it's a calculation. Mm-hmm. And there are calculations in the industry to work these things out. Budgets, definitely.
And then space, like Ian said earlier on, if the space that they have available to put the ice machine is a certain size, well, that will dictate what they end up buying as well.
Mm.
But again, the Scotsman range, we do it in inches. It's an industry thing, but 568 mil or 22-inch machine. We go all the way up to 200 kilos in a 22-inch machine wide in width. And then a 30-inch machine will go all the way up to 700 kilos. So you can, but then you're talking about extra height. So rather than it being
double stacking modulars,
than double stacking modulars, you just have one tall, narrow unit. A lot of people tend to have the headroom, but they never have the width.
Mm.
Yeah. So 22-inch or 30-inch machine and the gap that you've got, and you've got endless height, then perfect.
Ventilation.
Yeah, well, the 22-inch machine vents out the top.
Right.
So then if your ventilation, that's where it comes, then it helps with that, or you have the 30 inches vent out the sides, whichever way. And you can actually edit both of them to do whichever.
Yeah.
There's a lot to it, really.
Yeah, a lot.
It's not just an ice cube.
Yeah.
I mean, one of your barista champions, his Scotsman ambassador, recently said that he only uses Scotsman for ice because of the low mineral count and the slow melting qualities. I mean, how does a machine ensure that quality and purity?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways of that. Obviously, water filtration is quite important. You know, it's putting a filter on.
Really.
It's also one of our biggest bugbears in the market, but I'll touch on that after this. But because of the way Michaelis, the barista, he would talk about that, talking about the gourmet cube. The gourmet cube is formed, let's see if I can paint a picture in everybody's mind, is an egg cup upside down. So like an egg, where you would store all your eggs, and you're like an egg box, more like. Mm. And then the spinning bit in your dishwasher that cleans your dishes, well, that's clean, purified water that then sprays into those egg cups, and it freezes upside down, which means all the impurities and all the heavier minerals fall out of the water, and you're left with as close to pure water as you can. The big thing about that is that, and the reason Michaelis says what he says about the product, is that more minerals in the ice, less clear the cube, but also the flavor changes for coffee.
So water.
Yeah,
so absolutely.
The wrong water in a whiskey. That's why if you go to a PE whiskey, you want the water to match it.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, you don't want is an ice cube that is filled
like
with impurities.
Guinness used to taste differently around the world.
Yeah, because the water coming in makes that flavor change. Yeah. So water filtration, taking out TDS
reintroducing it as well, certainly in coffee world.
Yeah, you reintroduce with reverse osmosis systems and different things like that you could put in line, remineralizing. There's a product that we do that has the ability to remineralize at a level. So we have added that now to coffee machines.
Mm.
Which allows you then to dial in exactly what mineral content you want for the particular bean that you're buying.
Can change the flavor profile just by
massively,
doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we've proven there. So ice is no longer just ice, and there's a lot to it, and it should be considered properly.
That's what we're taking from this.
I like that. I like the word ingredient, and I think that's an educational piece, isn't it? It's not just ice, it's an ingredient.
Yeah.
So going now on to sort of a broader industry subject, we'll maybe just start around design, CAD, BIM, and then go into like wider industry. Ian, I mean, your CAD's been around forever.
It has.
If you like.
It's the old man's technology, as the kids call it these days.
You know, even from my perspective, I would still say we're still probably 80% in CAD, 70% in CAD, you know, like
it's lower than that.
And then BIM is often not being taken up because it's more expensive
significantly,
sometimes.
Yeah,
yeah, to work with that and all of the clashes and all that everything goes on with it. What's your perspective on
so
that?
When I started my business in 2020 up until 2023, 5% of my turnover was BIM related projects. Beyond that, that's jumped up. But it still represents maybe 20% of the business turnover.
Okay.
So where BIM tends to come in, so let's qualify that. CAD is a 2D process, and most people recognise as CAD is a 2D plan, and for 80% of projects, that is more than enough, predominantly where there isn't an architect involved or there is other technical stakeholders involved. So if you imagine somebody's opening a little cafe and they want to get an understanding of the arrangement, it's essentially a spatial design, and they then want to do a bit of coordination with that design by adding on the services, and it's a simplified process, and it's a cost-effective, more than adequate process for 80% of projects. However, when you get into a project that's into the millions or into the hundreds of thousands, and there's 8 floors of a building with 5 different surveys on it or 5 different kitchens, the complexities of that, a 2D drawing just doesn't cut the mustard on that. And so you need something much more complex. And this is where BIM comes in. And as an industry, we've been very slow to adopt to it. Bearing in mind, it's been a requirement on government projects for quite some time now. I think it was 2008, maybe earlier. And so there's been a requirement for it, but our industry's been slow to adopt it. And that's why there's such pressure on the platforms to provide this information, particularly the manufacturers. Yeah. I actually helped some of the manufacturers produce these symbol libraries because they're getting the demand now. Mm. One of the reasons why the demand has jumped up, it seems as if the new generation of architects, the new generation of companies that deal with these kind of projects, the wider world, are using BIM significantly more, where CAD is now the support software rather than the main software. Whereas, and that's what I mean by CAD.
I think it's like more like of an attitude of people being more visual now. Like people kind of want to see what they're getting rather than the 2D, and maybe they aren't able to build it themselves in their mind, right?
So from a sales point of view, BIM is fantastic because you can produce rendered images, and that makes it very easy to sell to clients because people buy something they understand. Mm. But it's not a pretty CAD file, is BIM. It's significantly more than that. Mm-hmm. So one item can have 20 or 30 elements of attributes attached to it, and it breaks it down quite definitively. And when the idea of a BIM model is it is a digital copy of the building that will actually get created.
Yeah, yeah.
So imagine every single item is included in there, and every single item has all that detail attached to it. So it might be its dimensions, its kilowatt loading, its heat ejection, the water connections, whether it needs a filter, all these things, the water flows, etc. It goes on and on and on and on, you know. And so when you're dealing with a kitchen, when you think how heavily serviced a kitchen is, how many elements make up a kitchen, you can understand why there has been a shift towards using more BIM. So the way I would look at it is CAD will always be, CAD's been around since the 50s, 1950s. It will always still remain as an underlying thing that people will still use. There's nothing better than a 2D plan just to get a sense of a space. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, like you were saying before, visually people don't understand plans like they used to do, and the sales teams don't understand the plans either. There's been a generation of really, here's the design, rather than explaining it. So I think when you've got a 3D visual, immediately you've got that facility to
sell
it.
Easy to understand.
And also with all the things that we've got now, you know, we've got the technology now where we can give a client a pair of goggles and they can stand in the middle of their kitchen and have a look around the kitchen. They can walk around it. And it's amazing how often a customer will go, oh, well, how am I going to get all that to go together? Where's this? Where's that going to live? And quickly, they can see it much more than they would have done if it was a 2D plan. Because obviously, a 2D plan doesn't have the elevations necessarily. Mm-hmm. That's another area that we're getting more and more inquiries for. Elevation drawings, elevation services. Because the service teams, they want to be able to, project managers, rather than having to go to site and walk them through a service drawing and explain everything, they want it done for them. So,
the power of teams.
And because people aren't travelling to site as much as they used to do, the BIM stuff really does come in for that.
And George, from your perspective, I mean, we're looking at kind of the wider industry issues, as in our the end user, if you like, the customers.
Yeah.
What are the biggest challenges that you're kind of seeing in the market, you know, when you talk to distributors or end users or national accounts, you know, generally?
Yeah.
Is it labour? Is it costs?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it, I mean, the, probably the first thing that I would say is a lot of it is price driven, capex spend, and how much how much from there. I mean, there's always, every year we have this sort of opex capex battle where somebody decides that I'll spend a load of money on keeping it going, but they spend as much money on keeping it going as they could have done buying a new one. There's a lot of skill loss as well. So, like, one of the, definitely for us from the refrigeration perspective is, the skill level or the new refrigeration engineer doesn't really exist like they used to.
Yeah.
The engineering part has changed, and you know, there's a lot of very good engineers out there that we rely on a lot, but then there's also an industry where it's become parts fit and change, and hopefully it fixes the problem with and losing a bit of that knowledge
through like diagnosis.
Yeah, so they don't
diagnosis engineers.
There would be a bodge every time. You would always be funny. You would go and find out that somebody's put some ducting on the side of an ice machine to try and get some heat away, right? Because somebody understood the principles of ducting.
Yes.
Now they just go, well, it's too hot in here. Oh, well, you're going to do something about it? Well, no, your ice machine's too hot. Do you know, there's no, it's a blame the product culture rather than
somebody else's
fix the problem.
Yeah.
So that new refrigeration engineers, new people in the market are definite a thing outside of CapEx that, you know, you can send a refrigeration engineer to your product and they won't fix it like they used to. And then to compound that, the EU's directive of changing to R290 gas, green gas refrigeration changes. Well, there's a huge implication in that because it's propane, right? It goes pop if you get it wrong.
Don't put them in cold rooms.
Yeah, so they've changed the regulation without actually consulting the market. So now you have this new green refrigerant that isn't as efficient as the old refrigerant, so it doesn't work as well. So its yield is a little bit less, and because its heat exchange isn't as good, right? So if you want to produce 300 kilos of ice and your old room was really, really hot, then the old one would have worked because it was on 404, 449 because it, you know, cooled down a lot more and heated up a lot more.
Yeah, yeah.
So you now got a really, really warm room that now you need to cool more with 150 grams of R290. Well, it doesn't work as well.
So you have to increase the compressor size, so the efficiency is not as good.
Yeah, so to be able to get to that level, you need to then consider a machine that used to work in that environment will no longer work in that environment.
Right.
If you put an ice machine in a cold store, an old refrigerant would have enough duty to knock the ice out of the evaporator, right? Enough heat exchange to heat enough heat. Well, R290 doesn't produce as much heat as 449 or 404. So now the cold room where the ice machine used to be is now too cold for the ice machine. Ironically, it's too cold for an ice machine, right? So it's been able to spec that.
Why are you putting an ice machine in a cold room for starters? But well, that's another conversation.
It's all about space. It's all about space.
Yeah, and not heat ejection.
They need a better designer.
Room that's trying to refrigerate.
I know, right? I know, but this is if you go to pubs and restaurants around the UK, it's a crazy.
That's the reality.
Yeah, it is the reality of it. Yeah. Or because it's the last thing to think about, they put it on an outside wall. Which has a, you know, it works
direct
beautifully
sunlight.
or works beautifully in the summer, and for some reason in the winter it stops working. Do you know why has that happened? Well, it's -4 degrees outside, that's the reason it stopped working. But it's an ice machine. Well, yeah, okay. But yeah, there's a few nuances of different things that causes a bit of trouble, but I would say CapEx and skill level in the market now is probably the thing that's causing us the biggest trouble.
And that's been the big push in the industry. The industry is to de-skill and to try and make the process more efficient and more consistent. That's part of the reason why the de-skilling is to increase the consistency.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in a coffee shop, if the machine, if it's a proper manual barista machine, on Monday it's absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But on Tuesday, when Gladys is doing the machine, the coffees aren't quite as nice.
Yeah, yeah.
And on Wednesday, when Antonio's doing it, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is the problem when you've got a skill set. If you can rely on a skill set, that's brilliant. And I would actively encourage development of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that there's so much turnover in the hospitality industry that companies are having to de-skill in order to get consistency.
Consistency, people expect that. So, and in, you know, as a designer and a consultant in the market, if people are setting up a new kitchen or a new bar, is there one bit of advice you could give them? You think, you know, and I'm going to come to you as well, George, you can't say ice machines.
The main thing is viability. So will it work?
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a case of, you know, like any new business do your research. Think about, is this a solution that's needed? Is the property going to be suitable for what you're wanting to do? You know, think about your ventilation, obviously. Think about the space that's going to be available for the kitchen. Is it going to be the right place for service? Is it going to be the right place to get deliveries? Is it going to be the right? Are you going to be able to get enough power to it? Because, of course, there's been a huge shift from gas to electric. So we're getting clients that are, oh, we want it all electric, but then they realise they need 100 kilowatt of power and they haven't got 100 kilowatt of power.
Or it costs them 60 grand to
and
get.
And it's going to get to cost them a fortune to get that. And then it offsets, the, oh, we best go back to gas, and then they find that they've got enough gas. So those are the things that we have to think about. It's a huge part of a new project is just looking at it in a more wider spectrum. Think of, don't just focus on the nice, shiny new plancha like you were saying earlier. You know, think about the bigger picture. One of the things that we're seeing in efficiencies, obviously, is thinking about refrigeration. Green companies are starting to look at the green credentials for company equipment. Less about the fact that it's green. It's the fact that because it's green, it's probably more energy efficient. So you see multi-tiers these days with doors on, whereas they used to be open. And it's energy efficient. Yes, it's a green thing. But the reality is that's going to save them money because refrigeration equipment runs pretty much 24/7. So if you're going to think about your equipment, think about what's your fixed costs. So refrigeration is one of them because it's a 24-hour process. So if you can reduce the cost, so instead of spending 300 quid on your bottle machines, your bottle coolers, maybe spend 900 quid on your bottle coolers. But those bottle coolers will A, last an awful lot longer and cost you significantly less to run long term. So it's things like that to consider. You can go beyond that, the bigger groups think about demand control ventilation systems, for example. So that's systems where the canopy actually speeds up the fans, speed up or slow down according to what's being done underneath the canopy, how busy the kitchen is. So there are other areas, but that's really a thing to think
so
about.
Viability.
Will it work?
And briefly from your side, George, any bit of advice that you would think for setting up a new business, new kitchen, new bar?
Yeah, I think...
Obviously, we've talked about ice and you know what.
I think for me, obviously, from the other side of our business, one of the biggest things that is maybe an oversight is that, let's say, for instance, you want to start a smash burger business. Mm-hmm. You want to become a smash burger restaurant and you want to serve that product. And then you design your menu, you want to do beef patties, you want to do all the different things, and then you buy your grill after the fact, and you then decide that that's the grill that you're going to use. Now, does your quality suffer? Have you chosen the right piece of equipment to cook the products that you want? I want to serve, you know, a 1,000 milkshakes a week. Well, you're not going to do that with a 13 amp plug countertop unit. You're going to need
triple
to have something.
Spindle mixer or
yeah,
whatever.
You're going to have to add bits to that. I want to add all these flavors. The piece of machinery that you do it with is super important. Whether it's ice, whether it's a grill, whether it's an oven, choose the right one.
Yeah,
it's don't a huge, value engineer.
Yeah, it's value engineer something like that. You're going to suffer because you're going to save money on the front end with your capex, and your operations are going to suffer. So that saving that £3,000 on buying the right ice machine or buying the right oven or whatever it may be isn't really truth. It's a false economy. You'll not save in the long term. I think when ingredient suppliers...
And in the not too long term, actually.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah, when ingredient short suppliers talk term, about... Yeah, yeah. Mm. You talk about new products for ingredient suppliers that go out. You know, we have connections with a lot of milkshake or soft serve suppliers who sell that product. And they go out and they do all the sales. And then they go, perfect, that's them signed up for selling this product. And then they don't have a machine to do it, and then they put it in the machine, and then it doesn't work, and then the machine gets blamed because it could be that it's just not been programmed.
Fault.
Yeah, it's just not been programmed correctly. So I think at the base level, equipment sales and that knowledge for new businesses is get your equipment supplier and your ingredient supplier together at the start, and then build your menu, and then get it, and then you have the right service, and you've almost got a reason to spend the money.
Thanks for that. We're coming to the end of the podcast. We've just got a short amount of time left, so we're going to get into a non-industry kind of industry quick fire round, and it's a quick fire round, so I want you to short answers for me. Just going to go through it. So George, we'll start with you. Best city in the world for food.
Quick fire answers. New York.
Cool.
My hometown, Leeds.
Why New York? Just quickly for me, then. We'll...
Just vast choice of anything that you want, whenever you want it. It's phenomenal.
pretty much the same answer. You can pretty much eat anything you like. You can go to a really old pub and drink beer that was made literally just down the road.
Nice tapas place in Leeds. Really nice.
All the people from Edinburgh will kill me for what I just said.
If you could eat one cuisine for the rest of your life, Ian, what would it be?
Italian, hands down.
Well, you're just saying that we've got Italian in the studio.
It's simple, quality ingredients, fantastic results.
Fantastic.
Unfortunately, I'm going to say the same thing. But pizza, specifically pizza. A sourdough, crisp-based pizza. Oh, yeah. That's my death row meal, is a pizza.
Oh, mine's Tony Hill, sorry. Oh.
When you walk into a restaurant or bar, what's your kind of pet peeve that winds you up the most, or isn't there?
Yeah, I don't think I have one. I think maybe the time it takes to sit down. I don't like queues. I'm not a queuer. My wife would kill me for I never stand out some size of
mine. Mine's being ignored.
Okay.
I just think it speaks to a lack of attitude towards customer satisfaction. I think if you go sit down and then just leave your be, I can understand why they might do that. But at the same time, the whole point of hospitality is to be attentive. That's the point behind it. So I think
the Americans do that well. That's a good thing about New York. After their,
well,
but then
tip as well,
incentivize our create a tip culture in the UK a bit better. Then, I think we're miserable.
So, best piece of a career advice someone's ever given you?
The guy I worked for the co-op when I was 17 years old, 16 years old, out of school, and my old manager, rest in peace, said to me, "Don't go to university; it's a giant waste of time. Just get a job and start working."
Couldn't agree more.
Cool. Yeah. Like
couldn't
that.
Agree more. Mine's actually not from the industry; it was from an autobiography I read, and it really stuck with me. And anybody who knows me has heard this, say this before. And it's called "Aim to Be a Zero." Chris Hadfield, a Canadian astronaut, is quite famous for this phrase. And it's basically, your job needs to be, your first job is not to be a liability. You know, get it right first time.
Hmm. Okay, like that. And finally, if you walk into a bar and you're going to order a drink, what kind of ice must it be served with? I guess it depends on the drink, you're going to tell me.
But. Exactly right. Yeah, what is the drink that you're having? If you're having a really nice whiskey, you know, you want something that will not change the flavour of the whiskey. So you want a good, solid gourmet cube. If you want to make a nice cocktail, then you've got loads of options to shake within that with that gourmet cube. It's choosing something of quality. If you're in wanting to make a blended drink, then you want something like a dice cube that will blend down nicely and then also fill your glass and keep everything cool.
So I'm not a big drinker, but occasionally I will have an old-fashioned.
Old-fashioned.
And it's got to be done properly. Yeah. And it has to have one piece of ice, a big piece of ice, and without question.
Scotsmen do an XL cube, which is 60 grams.
We had 60 gram ice
60
cube.
Gram ice cube. And we had a really, if I've got time, we had a site in Port Rush in Northern Ireland that we used to get constant calls of issues with this machine. It kept breaking. And we never understood why. And the reason being is because the MC1210 XL cube that dropped out of this machine was so large that it would smash the bin eye off the bin every single time. So then we had to put it on a timer, because every time this ice cube fell into the bin, it was denting the bin. It's a giant piece of ice. Great piece of equipment.
That's a great little anecdote, that.
Okay, well, thank you for some fantastic answers.
Thank you.
Interesting podcast. It brings us, sadly, to the end of this episode. So I just want to say a huge thank you to Ian Clay from Hunsworth Food Service Design and Ducted Solutions, and George Fell from HTG Trading and Scotsman. Ian, people want to find out more about your business. How do they get in touch with you?
Hunsworth.com and DuctedSolutions.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. On Ducted, there's some blog posts that fills in a little bit more of the gaps as to what we do, why you might want to use our services. Those are the good places to start.
And same for you, George. People want to find out a bit more about Scotsman range. What's the website where they head to?
Yeah, so hubbardsystems.co.uk covers the Scotsman range for us. Yeah, has all our details and stuff like that. And the HDG website will link you to that as well. So if somebody searches HDG Trading, they'll come across the Scotsman product that way too.
Cool. But thank you both for joining the show. Hope you've enjoyed it.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
Well, as you heard, that brings us to the end of this podcast. And thank you to our sponsors, Scotsman and Ali Group, for sponsoring this episode. You've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity, and I hope you've enjoyed this episode and this show. And we've actually, in the last 90 days, we've gone over 70,000 listeners in 62 countries. So it's absolutely huge, really. So thank you to all our listeners as well. Until next time, when I see you next, I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is a Sound Rebel production.